Welcome back to Musinomics. I'm Larry Miller from the Music Business Program at NYU Steinhardt and the Sony Audio Institute. This is the third episode in our series on music and artificial intelligence. In the first episode, we focused on the state of play, what AI tools are already capable of, who the major players are, and how quickly this technology is moving into the mainstream of music creation and distribution. In the second episode, we examine litigation, regulation, licensing, copyright, and monetization, the legal and economic battles now unfolding between AI companies, rights holders, creators, and policymakers. But today, we want to look forward, because regardless of where the lawsuits land or how regulation evolves, one thing already seems clear: AI is not going away. The real question now is not whether AI will affect music, it's how deeply it reshapes the entire music industry value chain, from creation to marketing to discovery to rights management to fan engagement to the structure of the music business itself. And maybe most importantly, what becomes more valuable in a world where content itself becomes infinitely abundant. So today, we're moving beyond the fear versus hype cycle. We're asking what the future music ecosystem may actually look like over the next 5 to 10 years. And joining me today are two terrific guests. Sherry Hu is the founder of Water and Music and a friend of the pod and one of the sharpest analysts tracking the intersection of music, technology, infrastructure, and creator economics. And Daniel Rowland is VP of Strategy and Partnerships of Lander, one of the leading AI-enabled music creation and production platforms serving creators around the world, and an instructor in recording industry technology at Middle Tennessee State University, MTSU. Welcome back to Musinomics.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
What feels materially different today from 12 to 18 months ago?
I can start with this. So what is totally different? I mean, I think so much in the world has changed over the last 12 to 18 months, and some of that can map onto the microcosm of AI music. In terms of the technology, the models have improved so much, and I think there are new models that are being released at an increasing pace. I think just this morning, as of recording, Stable Audio 3 is now released. So we're going to see a whole new class, a whole new generation of models coming out. So the technology is improving at an accelerating rate. On the commercial side, as of like the last 6 to 12 months, we now have a whole new generation of licensing deals between all the largest AI music platforms like Suno, Udio, 11 Labs, and both major and independent labels and music bodies like Merlin, Cobalt, Believe as well. Yeah. So,
although as of today, not all three majors.
Not all three platforms.
Right. Correct. And it's important to mention that those deals are in place, but that doesn't mean that those models are trained on that data yet.
Correct.
So their deals have been done, but it doesn't mean when you use those platforms that you're using ethically trained models.
Yeah, yes, exactly. To be clear. So yes, the deals have not been translated into something that's actually in production yet, although that's definitely actively being worked on right now. So yeah, I would say the commercial stakes are much, much higher now in terms of getting things right around compensation, around transparency, around how that money actually flows. I think that's like the big difference for me.
Yeah, it's the legal side of things. It's just the public's awareness and adoption of or angst about it, as more people seem to be learning. Some of the, you know, the person on the street now almost knows something about AI generated content and something about ethical or that kind of a thing, right? Sort of where, you know, at one point, no one really knew that Spotify, you know, the perception was it didn't pay artists a lot. Now everyone on the street is aware that artists don't make a lot of money from streaming generally, right? It's kind of a similar thing.
Most artists don't.
Most artists, no, they don't, right? So, but that seems to be the average lay person who's not even in the music industry is aware of that. And I think you're starting to see some of that with AI. And it's, you know, the rise, as you said, of some new models. The 11 Labs model is an example. We're starting to see more purely ethical, you know, licensed data sets. Lander, it was one of the two companies behind the 11 Labs model on the data side of things. So we were a big part of that. And of course, they've made deals that will bring much more data into that and make that model even better and blah, blah, blah. So I think, yeah, the rise of alternatives that have allowed businesses to participate more in the generative AI space than they would have before, because they certainly weren't going to leverage Suno or Udio or something like that, where they could be legally exposed in the future. That's still this nebulous sort of a thing that, yeah, that people have to navigate.
For music creators, have we moved from experimentation to normalization yet, or is that still ahead of us?
I mean, I cannot wait to hear what you have to say about this. We're not at normalization yet. Well, it depends, right? Of course, it depends who we're talking about. If you're talking about kind of the casual creator that usually is a gamer and that's now kind of experimenting with music, that's fairly normalized, I think. Prosumers, to some degree. The pro tier is what's so fascinating to me, which is kind of the area that I exist in, where it is, I mean, in the songwriting industry, it's the penetration is insane, right? In Nashville, the K-pop industry, I would say, no matter, you know, forget about the training data side of things, generative audio, generative music is the most transformative songwriting tool ever to exist, right? It is unbelievable what you can do with that. And the inspiration, you're starting to see artists step up and admit that. Teddy Swim, somebody who's a more traditional artist, has come forward and said, this is amazing what we can do. You know, the Donald Glover quote I always use is, or Childish Gambino is, you know, it allows me to make mistakes quicker, right? And you can experiment in ways, especially in things like K-pop, where the velocity of writing is so fast, right? You don't have time to experiment generally. And this is from interviewing and being in these sessions. Now they can try different stuff. And it allows people to be a little bit more creative than they might normally be and step outside of their own sonic palette, their box. I think it's absolutely fascinating for that. And we've seen a shift in adoption. And last thing, I do a panel at NAMM every year for the past 7 years on AI. You know, it's been people throwing stuff at me generally, you know what I mean? People angsty about it. And certainly in 2025, the audience was, it was a couple hundred people in the room. And I mentioned, you know, the Suno CEO's quote about music generation, and people were just like, rah, like, you know, it's like a riot. And then this year we talked about it and half the room was using Suno. So it was a completely different vibe on that. And that's been my experience largely out in the industry, but no one admits it. And that's the thing, right? Same thing with Lander. No one wanted to admit it, or still don't want to admit they're using automated mastering, even if they do, because they feel like it cheapens what their art, because they didn't go hire a human. Anyway.
Yes, just a few additional points that come to mind to build on everything that Daniel, you just said. So I think it was in the last month that the Suno mobile app hit number one.
Yep.
In the music category on the App Store.
Wow.
Above all the streaming services, including Spotify.
It got up to number 11 in the total apps on the App Store for a day. And then it dropped back down to like 22. But that's still nuts.
Still pretty crazy. Yeah. So I think, this breakdown of the casual consumer or everyday fan versus a professional creator is really useful, because Suno is certainly, I think their grand vision and their valuation of like $2.5 billion. That is a consumer bet.
Yeah.
I think they are betting on becoming a consumer entertainment app more broadly. And so certainly compared to a lot of their competitors like Udio, for example, they've invested so much in social media marketing, influencer marketing. And so I think that will drive a lot more, if not adoptions, yeah, for sure, awareness, just realization that this is a thing that is around in that kind of casual consumer fan population. On the professional creation side, a few things come to mind. So in the first episode of this series, I believe I made a distinction between assistive versus generative AI, just in terms of the technical paradigm. Like, are we creating new audio or manipulating existing audio? On the mostly assistive side, for sure, seeing more and more artists like speaking out in support of that. I think the biggest example of this is Charlie Puth becoming the chief music officer, having like a very official partnership with Moises, and talking very openly about how he and his peers use that kind of tech every single day, which is a lot of like just stem separation, vocal isolation, cleanup, etc. And then not to keep going back to a quote from Mikey Shulman, the CEO of Suno.
Oh, I didn't even say it. I'll let you say it. Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, go ahead.
But he has this quote that Suno is like the Ozempic of music.
Yes.
That everyone uses it and nobody's talking about it. That is intentionally meant to be very alarming.
That's kind of his shtick, is to say things.
It's a little provocative.
Yeah. He's also speaking to investors when he's talking publicly, not to, you know, the average creator, and certainly not to musicians who are inflamed by a lot of these comments.
Yes.
Yeah. And he knows what he's doing. Yeah.
Yes. And just one more anecdote that I'll bring up. I was recently in Denmark for a music conference, and Denmark is now one of several countries where there has been an AI song that has topped the charts. But at this conference, they were talking through, like, behind the scenes how they made this song, and it was a professional production team that spent like 6 months experimenting with these tools. What's so interesting is that they were experimenting with the likes of Suno in actually a very assistive way.
Yep.
Just like, I love this phrase of like making mistakes faster, or like generating all the possible ideas faster to, and then experimenting with how to combine all those different elements, still with a very like hands-on professional production setup. So I found that to be really interesting and kind of a nice counterpoint to a lot of what people are talking about, which is also happening, of like just one click, make a song.
Yeah. Boy, this is a rabbit hole we could go down. I've been talking people off the ledge about this type of tech for over a decade now, AI specifically. I was very lucky to get involved early at Lander, right? So I've been the face of that company, getting, you know, bruised and everything from people yelling at me. But it's, yeah, I mean, the part people forget about this is, yes, of course, there's assistive tools, Lander, you know, mastering, stems, things that would be impossible without AI, stem separation being one. We've been trying to do that as engineers forever, and there's just no real way to do it without AI tools. But even in the context of generative AI, there's assistive ways to use that. And that's predominantly how people are going to use it. I think when people are triggered by a new technology, they tend to go to the like dystopian worst case scenario, which is some kid in his basement is going to generate 100,000 songs and put it on Spotify, and or it'll go into a sync library, and or this or that, right? And I, you know, it's been said before by Quincy Jones and others, right? You can use a hammer to build a house. You can use it to kill somebody, right? Of course you can use AI for that, but that's predominantly not what it's used for. I mean, professionals and even a lot of amateurs are not just typing in, you know, song about sunset and that's all they're participating in. They're curating and getting to a goal. When I play guitar, I'm curating the notes that I'm playing. When I produce, I'm curating the instrumentalist in the room, you know, the arrangement and all of that stuff. You can use AI tools like that. And like I said before, and I think it does in most cases, expand your creative palette and take you into areas you wouldn't have gone in. And when it's used properly, whatever that means, I think it really can expand not just what music is being made, but the public's appetite for things that are a bit different if they can all make fairly generic pop music in their pocket, right? That's at least the glass half full take on my side of things. And I think people just need to sometimes forget about, just because you can prompt something quick and get it, you can do the same thing with MIDI. I can get six samples off Splice and paste them out and do the same thing, right? It's the scale, I think, that worries people more than anything else.
Daniel, how do you see professional creators changing the way that they are using AI tools?
Oh, man, it's one of the biggest applications right now. I mean, we mentioned the songwriter side of things, and it's important to say those people aren't releasing that music at all. They're just using it to ideate and experiment on arrangement and lyric writing and all that kind of stuff. So it's amazing there. Big in hip hop for sampling, right? Mm-hmm. It's the resurgence, it's the golden age of sampling, 2.0, where, originally people felt the freedom to sample whatever they wanted because they weren't concerned about rights and stuff, which obviously we had to work that out in the industry. And that's kind of what they're looking at with Suno, right? They can make, now they have more control over what they're sampling, right? They can input lyrics, they can, make stuff that's really crafted for what they want. And for better or worse, right now, there's no rights involved. So it's very easy for them to go forward. Now, there may be retroactively issues with that. But, young artists aren't often thinking about that stuff, right? I work on a lot of hip hop music for Atlantic Records and others. And it's still something where people sample music and don't realize that they have to get it cleared and all that stuff. So a lot of them just kind of circumvent that and go through Suno. So that's a big deal. And in production, I mean, it's just... Yeah. I mean, I talk to a lot of, what's the biggest problem that every single artist, songwriter, musician in the world has? It's finishing a song, right? We all have dozens, if not hundreds of ideas over decades lying around. To be able to revisit those things that you probably wouldn't normally revisit and get re-inspired through something like these tools is incredibly valuable. And then you take that in a completely different direction or whatever, right? But yeah, that's the, again, that's my glass half full take, but that's the people that I know they're using it. That's what they're using it for.
Sherry, let's turn toward the music industry and what operational impact is already occurring inside the music industry in terms of various business processes that the music industry undertakes every day, or what do you see coming over the horizon over the next 6 to 12 months?
Mm-hmm. So to clarify, are you interested in for this question also thinking about like business operations and not just music creation and
right.
the impact that AI is having.
Right.
This is such an interesting topic because I think the area where AI has had the most impact far beyond music is just building stuff, like making software. It has completely changed the life of a coder engineer. It has completely changed the job prospects of engineering in general.
Of many coders.
Many coders. I mean, we can expand that to so many different jobs as well, right,
sure.
in society. So I think the silver lining for the music business and like music business operations is that it's removed such a huge bottleneck for people to build a lot of solutions for themselves, for the industry, like especially on the rights management, royalty management side of things. I've heard of so many examples at this point of people who have gotten approval from their bosses or their company to use vibe coding tools to build like an internal dashboard in-house, what they otherwise would sell to have to like kind of shop around with a lot of different third-party vendors and have it be a multi-month, maybe even multi-year process to figure out who will build this. They can build in like a week or a few weeks. And so I think that kind of like internal entrepreneurial spirit to just like build the solutions that you want. I find that super interesting. On the startup side, that absolutely is transferring to there being a lot of AI native, like music industry facing startups. There's one example called Plates, which is, I would say they're more of a competitor to a Chartmetric in terms of music data analytics, but like the first thing that you see is very much natural language driven. You're not required to do a lot of manual like queries or like manual searches. It's like very much agentic. Chartmetric actually is like kind of releasing their own agentic features as well. So I think we're seeing just like the interfaces and the nature of engaging with tools like data tools in the music industry changing. And I think we'll see that across the whole business, whether it's for marketing, whether it's for rights management.
Yeah, on the legal side, on the marketing side, it's being
legal's
used.
Huge,
legal's
huge. Yeah.
Legal is massive, right? I talk to lawyers way. I probably should talk to them more. I'm talking to much less now than I used to. And it's even a company like Lander, and there's labels. We just ingesting all of our brand assets, right? And we just have a Bible now that's this agentic Bible that anybody who comes into the company can. They don't need to learn every little thing about our company. They can speak, and it will be put out in the format guaranteed every time that represents our company, our colors, our brand voice, all of that stuff. And it saves a tremendous amount of onboarding and in review. And the other thing I would say, not to pivot away from music business, is it's having the vibe coding thing is having a massive impact on the music software space, right? It's I keep track of new software companies that come out, and I stopped counting at it was 60 new plugin companies in the past 6 months, and that's more than in the past 10 years.
Wow.
And that's what that's doing for artists too, is that any producer or even music influencer that has any brand cachet is launching their own plugin line. Mike Dean is a famous music producer with The Weeknd. He's got dozens of plugins coming out, a DAW coming out. It's just like, it's so easy. He has a team that's just churning this stuff out because he's got an incredibly reputable brand, and he can monetize that now in a new way. And of course, that's now it's much more difficult to break through in that market, right? Because a lot of these people don't have R&D costs because of what they're using to code for the most part. It's all going to marketing. So it's fascinating now to watch that. And it's even affected us as a company about what we look to acquire. We're no longer looking to acquire plugin companies, right? Mm-hmm. It's not about features. It's not about product. It's about workflow and focusing on output. And that's what I think users are going to attach themselves to going forward.
Does AI impact today, or will it soon, core processes like A&R?
Mm. Let me think about this for a moment. So, okay. So in, I would say over the last 10 years, pre-ChatGPT, I remember there being, I think I even published an article at the time about this idea of Moneyball for music. So this was like 2017, 2018, very hyped up concept. There were a lot of startups at the time, like Sodatone, which got acquired by Warner Music Group. And then there's another one called Asai, I think, that got bought by Apple.
There's Instrumental and Meddling and some of these other ones.
Yes, those guys too.
Yeah.
Exactly. So these, for people listening who aren't aware, so these were all companies that were trying to apply data analytics to essentially like scouting and discovering artists. There was absolutely like a predictive element as well of trying to predict which artists were about to break or which songs are about to become huge hits.
And if you think about it, for a music company, I mean, that is a core source of competitive advantage.
Yes, sure, right? Yes, yeah. Absolutely. And now the likes of Warner, I would say at this point, all the majors do have like proper data analytics, data science teams. Mm-hmm. A lot of which has come from like acquiring these kinds of companies. So there was a big like hype cycle around that. My personal critique of that model is that A&R is so much more than just discovering an artist. Like I feel like the actual work that A&R teams do, there's actually so much that has to happen after you sign them, in terms of actually whether it's properly developing them or getting the right collaborators, finding the right sound, making sure that that taps into what listeners, what fans are thinking about right now. Like there is, I feel like there's so much more human manual coordination work to A&R that makes an artist break that is beyond just surface level consumption numbers. Yep. I think we're also seeing so many of these numbers being gamed these days. I think that's like a huge change to social media in the last like 10 years. So thinking about Gen AI applied to A&R, I think it absolutely can still help with like maybe this first level of like discovering the right artist, especially for like a pretty niche fan base or sound or community. I think it could still be really helpful, but I don't see it being all encompassing for that.
Yeah, I mean, they're just trying to raise their odds of success, right? That's really what it is. So you still have to put in all the legwork, otherwise it's not going to go anywhere. Yeah, I completely agree.
Not so long ago, we would talk about the democratization of music discovery, creation, even distribution, and the power of the incumbents, in particular the incumbent major music companies, was likely to be challenged. And I wonder if what we are living through now is a new kind of recentralization with respect to the power of the incumbent platforms that are operating at scale. I know that you've been looking at the entire music and music technology space now for what kind of feels like a long time, a decade or so, and that you recently published a story about this. What does your research say about that?
Yes. So this is definitely, I think AI is part of the story, but it definitely expands far beyond this. So for around the last 10 years, I have been tracking changes in ownership in the music industry with the focus on what like the major labels are buying up, but also the increasing influence of non-music companies, like whether it's VC firms, private equity firms, institutional finance firms, banks, etc. And so what compelled this me to make this market map and track this initially was seeing that Tencent, one of the largest tech conglomerates in the world, they own WeChat, which is like the biggest social platform in China. They have a huge gaming business. They started taking stakes in all the major labels, in Universal and in Warner, and they had an equity swap with Spotify. This was back in 2017, almost a decade ago now, which is crazy. So I was like, what is going on? Why is this big Chinese tech company now at the top of the food chain? And this is always how I like to think about it, is like who is the boss's 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 boss? And that will tell you a lot about the like, macro dynamics that are happening. So When you say re-centralization, the main trend that I think of when I look at the current state of the chart is the state of independent music distribution. Like, what does independence actually mean? So I think there was, I'm sure you have many thoughts on this.
I'm here. I know all of the stuff from reading Water and Music over the years. So that's why, please
don't. Thank you.
Same.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. But yeah, I would say like throughout the early 2000s, early 21st century in general, there was a wave of these independent distributors, CD Baby and TuneCore being some of the longest standing ones, and now kind of STEM, Too Lost being kind of like a newer generation of distributors that, where the promise to artists was, we are a genuine alternative to the corporate music industry machine. You don't have to sell your soul to get your music out there, or you don't have to give away your rights to get your music out there.
Open distribution platform.
Totally open.
DistroKid.
Yep. Oh, yes. Of course. DistroKid, yep. one of the biggest ones. Yeah. Yeah. And what we've seen over the last, especially 5 to 10 years, is that so many of these independent distributors have been bought up by the major labels. I think the Sony Able acquisition was the biggest example. And then most recently, of course, the Downtown acquisition, which got approved. It gives them access to CD Baby, to Fuga, which kind of powers white label distribution for a lot of music tech companies as
well. And just to be clear, the acquisition of Downtown by Virgin, the division of Universal Music Group.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Thank you. So now there's a new resurgence of this debate coming up of, like, what does independence actually mean? If you are an AWOL artist, is that independent? I think everyone in the industry will have like their own different taste on it. So that's kind of a really interesting example of that recalibration. And then I'll bring up AI as another example, just because in 2024, 2025, there were tons of funding rounds for new AI companies that were coming to the forefront, like the Sunos, Udios, 11 Labs has been on a tear with fundraising. But so far in 2026, the trend actually seems to be bending more towards consolidation of these companies rather than new startups raising funding. Like Splice acquired Kits, a voice AI company. They announced that earlier this year. And just with where their product is heading, I'm sure there are more acquisitions on the way. So we're seeing like these non-AI established music production companies buying up these AI startups, which I find really interesting. And my prediction is that AI will be a top exit category by the end of this year for music tech, but we'll see.
A lot of these kind of traditional companies are buying into these AI companies ahead of a potential exit, so that they look broader and they look like they're more future facing than they actually may have been in the past. Mm-hmm. Splice is a little different because they have Ale Koretsky, they have their own audio science team that's done quite a bit of development internally. They added Kits to that, but there's a number of examples of companies kind of tacking AI on through acquisition and inorganic growth and stuff like that. It'll be interesting to see how that plays out when they eventually go to market.
Is the future battleground then more about ownership of content or about ownership of the pipes?
I'd say the pipes, 100%. I don't know about you.
Totally, it's about infrastructure. Actually, to bring it back to the major labels, there's a huge debate that I think happens every year, but is always relevant to have, I think, about what is the value of a major label? So if you are an artist, like, what is the value of signing to them? Right. And I think in a world where major labels are sitting on super valuable catalog, but it is harder and harder for new artists to break through. You have this flood of AI content that is going into the market, which I think will make things more competitive if the labels don't find a way to own a piece of platform, or
even silo it. Yeah.
So it's like that, but then also, then does that shift the value away from like IP as a core source of value? It's a very interesting thought experiment. I'll bring up Universal as an example. I think in 2024, their big investor day, they shared that the fastest growing part of their business was not actually the label side or the publishing side. It was all the direct-to-consumer channels, like merch, like super fan clubs. Yep. It's still only like probably less than 10% of their business, but
growing rapidly.
Growing rapidly. I think it was like a 33% compound annual growth rate over it was a time period of probably like 4 or 5 years they were looking at. Since then, they have announced either investments or partnerships with a ton of these like fan engagement companies, like Even, which is kind of more like a direct music marketplace, like a Bandcamp. They invested in Stationhead as well, which has like these fan club listening party type experiences. So I think we're already seeing the major labels seeing the writing on the wall of, yes, they sit on a ton of valuable IP, but in terms of having an actual like forward facing view on what the role of a major label is, it'll be much more about owning the fan relationships. It'll be about having a proper stake in the tech companies that will define the future. I think AI is absolutely a part of that.
Completely agree. Yeah.
Sherry, you wrote in that same piece about the DAW-ification of of everything. What did you mean by that? And Daniel, I can't wait to hear what you
go first, and then I'm going to come on the next. Yeah. Right.
Yes. So this term DAW-ification, so DAW is a digital audio workstation. So this is just the interface that I would say vast majority of producers who are like especially working digitally are using today. So like an Ableton, Apple Studio, Logic Pro, etc.
Or Pro Tools.
Pro Tools, of course. Yes. So when it comes to AI, so for Water and Music, we have done various market mapping analysis of the AI music market for a few years now. And to go back to the assistive versus generative binary, that used to be, yeah, again, it used to be a very clean line that we could draw in terms of what these products were focusing on. Suno and Udio at the beginning had very limited editing functionality. It was just pure generative. The Moises of the world, much more assistive focused. I think because the market is so competitive, and also just because these companies do have grander visions for how they want to change the creative process, those two sides are all like meeting in the middle. I think with a few exceptions, which I'll name, but the vast majority of the market leading companies are trying to own everything. Like they're trying to, whether you want to only use assistive AI or do generative AI, like these companies now want to be your creative home. Like I think Suno with their Suno Studio, which for people listening who might not be aware, you can take a generation and like edit it on a per stem level, regenerate stems, rearrange certain parts. It's like rewrite lyrics. It's pretty granular, the editing that you can do. I think Udio has been working towards something similar. So like that's an example of owning the full stack. Even Moises, they now have their own browser-based AI studio where you can do like stem backing track generation. And then I forgot to mention that Lander literally acquired a DAW.
Yep. Oh yeah, we did. Right. Oh, thank you.
called Reason Studios. Yep. And I mean, I think just with Lander's business model, they like you all have been ahead of this DAWification trend for some time. And so the Reason acquisition felt very natural. But I think that in terms of like the bundling that happened as a result of that. So like now you can access all these Lander tools in addition to like the Reason stacks or kind of the Reason offerings as well. I think that's also an example of that.
Yeah, it's interesting. We've always been kind of the AI, a way to augment your existing DAW with all the Lander stuff, right? And so we never played in the DAW space because we were kind of agnostic to that. And we still are to some degree. We just happen to now own a DAW. And hopefully, honestly, that'll let us push some of the tech forward in a way that would be difficult for other companies to do, right? Because we own everything. But you're right. I mean, there's the, you know, what would have been sacrilegious 5 years ago is, you know, stem separation in DAWs is becoming table stakes, right? That's now like not everyone has it, but everyone there's opens. What's up?
Everyone needs it.
No. And it's one of the, again, it's one of those things that's easy to put in because everyone's worried about the optics of everything, right? Because you have, and some Reason is a great example. That DAW has been around for over 25 years. There's an older demographic that uses that DAW that is very reticent to engage with anything that has AI attached to it. Like they are, it doesn't matter what it is. They don't want to hear about it. That's fine, right? But stem separation, you can't do without AI, right? It's not taking anybody's job, right? It's not removing anything from the creative process. It's allowing you to do things you can't do otherwise. So those type of things are much easier to include. And that's why you've seen that as kind of the point of entry. A little bit of AI mastering with some of the DAWs, right? You're starting to see that. That's another, okay, we're moving a little earlier, you know, in the creative process, or, you know, what people deem to be creative. You're going to continue to see that creep. There are, because I'm involved in some of this stuff, many of the DAW companies are in talks to license generative models. And that'll be, at least one of them, that'll be in by the end of the year. And as soon as that happens, you'll start to see the other ones fall, right? Somebody just has to kind of break ground first on that and kind of take all the punches for it, you know, kind of like we did 13 years ago, right? And then everyone will follow. And it's important to remember, again, when I say that, people think, oh God, that means you're gonna be able to open Pro Tools up and hit a button and get a stereo composition of a song. No, there's lots of, we have a generative AI tool. And what it does is it looks at the music that you've composed. And if you want a saxophone solo, it will compose a saxophone solo over that works melodically over top of the harmonic arrangement. It'll change over time. If you have a sample that you love, I use this example all the time. It's great for Splice. It works with Lander and Loop Cloud and all these other tools. If I have a four-bar piano loop, traditionally I'm going and I'm cutting and pasting that or whatever, and it's a very boring sort of a non-dynamic way to compose music. Now you can take that and reinterpret it over 32 bars and have it breathe the way a player would breathe if you gave it to them as a reference, right? Mm-hmm. We can do things now that, as I love to say, makes music more musical when AI is applied in the right context. And that is what you're going to see inside of DAWs that I can't wait for. That's actually something that it's not going to be called AI in 5 years, right? It'll just be the way that software works. And then we start to lose some of the stigma that's attached as everyone's trying to raise money and use buzzwords and stuff. Like, that all goes away very soon.
Looking ahead, is the future music company in 10 years when our crystal balls are a little bit, you know, hazy? Is it a label? Is it a technology company? Is it a data company? Is it a combination of all of those things? What do you think?
I mean, it's, to me, I can't wait to hear what you have to say about this because you know more than I do. I mean, it's a combination. It's data workflow distribution, right? And that's, we are positioning ourselves very clearly to cover all those bases, and we're not the only ones, right? And that's, you know, companies much, much larger than us. Well, we'll navigate that as well. I think that's what you have to be. You have to own all three. Sure. And the audience as well. Yeah.
Yeah. So
let's not forget about the
eyes. Yeah, well, that's the distribution. I include them in distribution, but yes, you got to have the eyes and ears. Yeah.
Yes. So is the question or the thinking, like, what will the leading music company in 10 years look like?
Yeah.
How they operate?
Because, yeah. I mean, there are elements of all three of these in the largest music companies today.
Yes.
Yes.
Right?
Yes. So, yeah. Okay. Just thinking through this out loud, kind of similar to what Daniel just outlined, like what does it take to make the music industry work? You need artists, you need music creation, people who will lead that. I would say the two, maybe people in the industry will be mad if I say this, but I think the two most important groups of people are the artists and the fans, full stop, right? You need the artists who make the music, fans who like the music, and will support the artist. The industry is just meant to facilitate that.
Right.
I do think, I don't want to go so far as to say like a tech company will rule that, because I think, especially with social media, I think we've seen the dangers of especially like outsourcing culture to like tech platform incentives. I think just in our current very hyper-capitalist economy, I think there's just like a lot of dangers to that. That said, of course, tech will play a really important role in whatever company does lead in the future. So I think this example with Universal, which in spite of all this tech disruption, has maintained its position as the biggest major label in the world. A huge part of that, yes, has been investment in technology. I think this whole direct-to-fan, fan engagement area that I mentioned earlier is about technology. It is about data, like knowing who is listening and engaging and how and when they're engaging. So I think it'll be like a hybrid, like I actually wouldn't discount the influence of, I don't know if they'll still be called a label, but like these companies that are still controlling the production of culture just in a tech enabled way. I, I personally don't think it'll be the other way around of like a tech conglomerate that has like a cultural subsidiary that produces this. But that's my own opinion.
A really smart person once said to me that record companies, music companies, have only ever done four things going back over a century. Find great artists with good commercial potential. Take those artists and put them with great collaborators and make the music and the stuff around the music be as good as it can possibly be. Connect the music and the stuff around the music with the potential for good economic outcomes. And when those good economic outcomes happen, share the economics. Those four things have never changed. The way all four of those things happen has been changing at an accelerating pace. Mm-hmm. And I wonder to what degree you think the availability of AI in internal music business processes or the explosion of generative AI on the music creation side is going to change that equation.
One thing I would say that has actually kind of diminished over time out of those four things is the take the artist and get the right people around them side of things. I think that, yes, for some people, but artist development almost in a lot of labels doesn't exist anymore, right? It's more just, I work on hundreds of songs a month, right? And some of those are big artists and a lot of them are that kind of middle tier of artists. And it seems more like find what's hot, spit it out. I hate to say this out loud, but the mixes are, no one has ever checked the mixes. They're terrible, right? There's all sorts of issues that you could say is a lo-fi vibe thing, but no, it's across the board. It's clearly because even the people just are spitting
it
out.
It's just bad.
It's a vibe. Okay. We'll say that. But there's no QC process and there's absolutely no artist development in that, right? So, right. And if it hits, it hits. If it doesn't, it doesn't. It's music is ephemeral. It'll be gone the next day. That approach, right, I think is driving a lot of, unfortunately, of, music production these days. That's not always the case, but I think that's the part that's kind of lagging a bit. And perhaps, right, that's a part where AI can step in and kind of support those artists so that they know what they don't know, since no one else is apparently telling them. I could be wrong about that, but that's the one point I see kind of flagging a little bit.
If there's vibe coding, there's vibe musicking, vibe music making.
We call it vibe producers. That's the term we use. You hear the term vibe musicians used a lot.
Yeah.
We refer to traditional producers, hybrid producers, people who are using AI in a traditional way, and then straight up vibe producers, which are people who are just coming in and sort of engaging with the tools without contributing anything beyond prompting and maybe their voice.
Mm. It's very, very interesting. So, okay, kind of similarly, just thinking about what's top of mind in the industry discourse, there was a whole outcry around this Geese campaign.
Oh, yeah.
Which, yeah. it's so much to unpack there.
Describe what happened.
Yes. So, yes, Geese, they're, in my view, an amazing band. Very, like, edgy, experimental, kind of art rocky band based in Brooklyn, New York. Signed to Partisan Records, and the label worked with this agency called Chaotic Good, I believe, to run this campaign to help promote their latest album. That campaign involved what they called trend simulation, which I think in their case, they just ran this community of super young people for the most part, like teens, people in college, who they would pay to just like post these videos en masse that contained the song. They would pay to comment at the right time across all these different videos to try to drum up the idea that the song was blowing up. And so the algorithm on TikTok or whatever other social platform they were on would pick up on this as trending and then
and
that would
promote
eventually
it.
Catapult them.
Yeah,
my take on that, I bring that up in this like AI context because... One, I think that is the tip of the iceberg on what labels are doing for marketing. I think this is actually like super normalized now. There's very little in terms of music marketing on like a given social feed that is real. Like so much of it is manufactured a part of this machine. And AI, like the ability to not only create songs with AI, but also create like marketing material using AI, probably using AI agents to publish that and to manage that I get the sense that for some people in the industry, the way they are trying to work around that is to fight volume with more volume. Mm. So like, let's try to be the AI agents at their own game. And that feels very dystopian to me. So this is me thinking with putting on my hat of a music fan, just like the kind of, you know, online digital environment I want to live in is not this constant game.
Well, inauthentic. Everything is inauthentic, right?
Right?
So yeah, people do have a nose for authenticity.
Yes.
And the geese thing, it's so funny. You, to piggyback on what you said, when I heard about that, I was like, oh, well, that's super common. But I forget, most people don't know that. So the blowback on that was so massive. And Ed, this term that everyone loves to use, industry plant, right? Geese is now an industry plant, no matter how they came up. Oh, well, now let's go back and look who their parents were. Let's go back and research where they went to school. Like, this becomes a massive narrative online. One of the first times I remember seeing this, there was an artist whose music I mastered named Gail, and she had one of the biggest hits ever on TikTok. It was almost 2 billion streams now, I think. She was nominated for Best New Artist. She never had another hit after that. But one of the things that kind of caused her, I mean, she opened for Taylor Swift on the Eras Tour at one point, and just nothing was able to catch on because she was kind of a little bit of a, not a joke on TikTok, but people were kind of making fun of the song when it blew up. But some of what was found out, and hearsay or not, is that members of her label from the marketing team were kind of populating the TikTok comments with things to get people angsty and get them talking and get them moving forward. And of course, people go and they dissect all of that. And that she became had the tag of industry plant from a bunch of people in her fan base that then kind of migrated elsewhere. And I hope she's doing good, but she hasn't had a hit song and is not releasing music right now. So that's the kind of, and we talk about the TikTok trend, of course, as a cliff you can fall off if you blow up on TikTok, but people really do care about where they perceive that you came from. And if they think that they got to participate in your success and they find out that they were deceived in their participation, they do not forgive that.
Yeah. And I don't think we're at the point yet where AI, so like with these licensing deals, the likes of Suno and Udio are presumably going to come out with like licensed AI remixing apps where you can remix or reimagine like different versions of these established artists' songs, like artists who are assigned to these labels.
And make them available outside a walled garden.
That is what Suno
wants. That's up for debate.
Wants.
Yeah,
for
that's,
debate.
Suno,
for
that's
debate.
What Suno wants, yeah.
Udio's app will be a walled garden, so it will be closed. But actually, even like outside of the walled garden question, we're not at the point yet where the average fan, I think, will be willing to lean into that. It's still quite a niche behavior. It's still super polarizing. Like if a typical fan, especially for a pop or a rock artist or band like Geese, if they find out that AI was used at any point in the creative process, it's like a 50-50. It's like a coin toss in terms of how they would feel. Yeah.
Yeah, it depends upon genre. I mean, you have people like Diplo out there actively campaigning for AI and saying it's the best thing ever. And, you know, he would be fine with it. His fan base may or may not be cool with it. Yeah, it's tricky, right? Because getting back to just to authenticity on this remix thing and the people that are pushing a lot of this tech, you also have to look at who's paying them, right? I mean, Timberland is a great example of this, right? Where, you know, Suno backed up a truckload of money to his house and equity and everything to get him. And he's also, I think, genuinely likes it, but he's been a very complicated partner for them and some of the things he said, right? So, you know, I think, it's tricky. Yeah, Geese would be an issue, potentially an EDM artist or somebody else. It might not be that big of an issue if it's just a straight up remix. But whether you're, how that's released, is that just for social media? Is that just siloed inside of a walled garden? Is it something for DSPs? You know, there has to be quality control. Ours is going to want quality control somewhere on their voice and or their production likeness being attached to something, right? And how do we police that? I don't know.
Yeah.
Okay. And with all due respect to podcasts that have lightning rounds to wrap up, let's have a thunder round.
Let's go.
Biggest misconception people have today about AI and music?
That it's all the same. People just associate everything as the same, no matter what it's used for or what it's trained on.
Sure.
That's a good one. I would say.
Got you.
I would say that the biggest misconception is the one that we have already talked about earlier in this episode, which is that like all professionals hate it. I think like anecdotally, both of us would say that most professional artists we know in certain like commercial genres, especially pop, K-pop, country, like I would say it's like close to majority adoption rate.
Yep. And if it's not the artist, it's their production team. It's the people surrounding. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have to be the actual artists themselves. Yeah. Somebody in that chain is using it somewhere in almost 100% of cases, I would say at this point.
Okay, Sherry, what concerns you the most?
The future of critical thinking.
Oh, boy.
You took my answer. That's a big thunderclap right there. Yes.
Yeah.
I've seen this firsthand with writing, like the ability or lack thereof for people to form a critical thought or think critically about what they're facing in the world because they're outsourcing too much to, I guess in this case, a large language model. Very concerning to me. You are a professor, so I think this, especially in like education, it's like especially a concern these days. So that's my.
Well, yeah, not just think critically about what AI is presenting them,
yeah.
Right? I have 10 I could name here, but I'll just go on that one because I have two young daughters, right? And I do worry about, there's a line that's been drawn about people who existed as adults before AI, right? And had to navigate the world without it, and people that will never know a world without it. And that, I do wonder what that does to critical thinking. And who knows, it could be a net positive and people, they could, you know, I can't really say, but it's a little bit concerning.
Yes, it is. Like, for sure, AI has already helped with a lot of frontier, like, scientific discoveries. Like, I think the potential for that is amazing. But there were experts leading that research who were able to think critically. And, like, I think evaluation is a huge topic in just AI in general these days. Like, how do we effectively evaluate outputs and make sure we're thinking critically about them?
Yeah. Daniel, what makes you optimistic?
I mean, some of the stuff I talked about earlier, just focusing on the creator tool side of things, right? I do think where, as scary as AI is for a lot of people, it will lead to a bit of a creative renaissance in popular music included, that I think could be very cool. And I also Lander has the data to back this up. There will be a rise of a new creator class that might normally have been gamers. They might normally have done other things that would have never participated in music creation in the millions of people. And even if 5% of them decide they want to learn how to play guitar, to learn how to play the song that they generated, that they didn't know how to play an instrument to create, I do think we're going to see that trickle up into the more professional, the microphone sales, instrument sales, mastering engineers, right? All of that, I think, ultimately is a net win. But we're just in this kind of transition period where it's really scary for people.
Yeah. One thing, so to this question of optimism, it's also something that I wish more people would talk about, or especially try, is to like push AI models to their limits to just make weird sounds.
Oh, that's my favorite thing to do.
Yeah. Yes. Like, I feel like I would love to better understand this, of like what happens when like an AI model glitches. I think a lot of the industry discourse, which is warranted around AI music, is are these outputs that are just like perfectly polished, like the perfect country song or the perfect pop ballad. What happens if you use it genuinely as a creative tool in that way? I'm very excited about it.
And I come from the world of weird music, right? When I was a producer, like progressive rock, Adrian Blue, working with Trent Reznor and these people. And like the whole mission was to break a piece of, whether it was a guitar synthesizer or an EQ, make it do something it wasn't supposed to do, right? And I've said this a bunch, but like when AI hallucinates, that's where I want to be. Like that's what I'm interested in. I'm not interested in the output that I could have done myself. I want to break it by feeding it something it wasn't. You can totally do that with Suno. You can do it with 11 Labs. Oh my God, feed 11 Labs a guitar. Like you can do some really interesting stuff and you sample that and there you're in a territory you would have never gotten to with traditional production tools.
Sherry, in 5 years, will AI and music just feel like infrastructure or will it still feel like disruption?
It is so... so hard to say at this point in time. I will say, I think we actually are getting to a point now where, for example, I talk with a lot of founders and I get a lot of pitch decks just as a natural part of the work that I do. If founders are smart, they will not call themselves AI enabled at this point anymore.
Yeah.
Because aren't we all, you know, aren't we all in the world? So I think like AI as a buzzword that will get funding or deals, that is already starting to go away. So I think that's maybe leaning more towards the side of AI as infrastructure. It's just like technology as a tool to help you get what you have to get done.
Yeah, we're approaching the blockchain era of,
yes,
of the term AI, where it's like, okay, you can't just stick it on anything and expect to get, fun.
I think Snoop Dogg, a few years ago, in the hype of the NFT boom, he just randomly tweeted, we're in Web 5.
Yeah. Whoa, this blew my mind.
It was AI this whole time. Yeah.
Yeah. Ugh.
Sherry Hu from Water and Music, Daniel Rowland from Alander, thank you so much for joining us.
Awesome. Thank you.
Appreciate it.
This has been a fascinating conversation. And I think one of the most important things we can do right now is move beyond the simplistic narratives. Because the future of AI and music probably won't be entirely utopian, and it probably won't be entirely dystopian either. What it almost certainly will be is deeply integrated into how music is created, distributed, monetized, marketed, and experienced. And the decisions being made right now by creators, platforms, labels, investors, policymakers, and technology companies are going to shape the next era of the music industry. From the Music Business Program at NYU Steinhardt and the Sony Audio Institute, I'm Larry Miller. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.